You're listening to Investigates, the podcast that lifts the veil on some of the country's biggest crimes and mysteries. I'm your host for today, Stephen Downey. Boxing Day 2004, a day that many Australians remember, not because of how bloated they were feeling or who Australia played in the Boxing Day cricket test at the MCG, but because of the Boxing Day tsunami that struck 14 countries and killed more than 230,000 people.
Good evening. More than 11,000 people are now thought to have been killed in southern Asia after an undersea earthquake sent enormous waves rolling across the Indian Ocean.
So what happened when the wave hit? What was the aftermath like? And how did it change the way Australians viewed the world? 15 years on, the Indian Ocean tsunami, as it is now known, is still one of the deadliest tsunamis in history. And journalist John Burford joins me now to discuss it. How's it going, John?
I'm good, Stephen. Always good to be here.
Today we're talking about the Indian Ocean tsunami. 15 years this year, isn't it, John? A lot of Australians, they're waking up and eating their leftovers, I suppose, from Christmas Day lunch, and they're getting prepared to watch the Boxing Day test. And suddenly they turn on the news and they hear a devastating tsunami has hit.
It was unbelievable. I mean, the thing is, after Christmas Day, in media terms, it's always known as that quiet zone. Between Christmas and New Year, there's a Boxing Day test, and really there's nothing much else that happens. Well, that was the thing. Australians woke up the next morning and suddenly find there was this horrific event just to our north, with that involved all our closest neighbours like Indonesia and Thailand and Singapore and that whole area of Southeast Asia. But then when we began hearing the stories through about how many Australians were involved, it really took on a completely different perspective. And then when we began hearing stories about Australians being killed, I think it really hit home.
The tsunami hit 14 countries, including Thailand and Sri Lanka. However, Indonesia was the country that was the most damaged by the large wave. Hundreds of Australians were thought to be holidaying in these countries. And as news trickled in of the death toll, it became more and more apparent that this was a global emergency.
Of all the countries that were hit, Indonesia, you're right, was the hardest hit. However, the most number of Australians that died were actually in Thailand. 23 Australians died in Thailand and 3 died in Sri Lanka. But across the 14 countries that the tsunami literally hit, an estimated 230,000 people were killed. Some estimates are higher than that, but almost a quarter of a million. But Indonesia, you know, our very close neighbour, was literally just devastated. But it was in Thailand, particularly in some of the beach resorts like Phuket, full of holidaymakers, people enjoying their holidays, and 3 in Sri Lanka, where the most Aussies died and were injured.
John, let's talk about how it unfolded.
Sure. Sunday, 26th of December 2004, at 1:02, 58 minutes past midnight, a 9.1 magnitude earthquake struck off the west coast of Sumatra. It was the third largest ever recorded earthquake, and it lasted, get for this, between 8 to 10 minutes. Not seconds, minutes. So you can imagine what that was doing underneath the ocean. Pretty devastating. It also was 30 kilometres below sea level. So if you've got that kind of an eruption going on, it's causing all kinds of mayhem. However, because it was so low and because it was so big, it took a while for the impact. In some places, they said that the wave took about 15, 20 minutes to hit the coastlines. In other, the impact was literally between 7 and 8 hours to reach some of the coastlines of that Southeast Asia strip.
That's right. So that's why when we hear about these stories of especially in Thailand, where they're, you know, sitting around in the resorts and it's early morning and they're having maybe a morning swim, that's when we think, you know, we hear about those reports of the wave just coming in and wiping the resorts out.
Exactly. Well, so in the case of some of the places, and remember, it could have taken up to 7 hours to reach some of those coastlines. Back here in Australia, Eastern Standard Time, we're 3 to 4 hours, depending on daylight savings, we're 3 to 4 hours ahead of that. So it wasn't necessarily that we woke up to a lot of this news. It was happening in the morning of the news, in the morning as we were all enjoying Boxing Day. But for a lot of the people, actually, in the case of Thailand, we'll focus on that because that's where the most Aussies perished, was that there are stories of people literally going down for breakfast and looking out and seeing the coastline and seeing waves doing strange things and suddenly seeing the water. As one person I remember describing it, looked like they said it looked like somebody had grabbed the water and pulled it away from the beach. They said that was the only way they could describe it.
While researching this story, John spoke to Melbourne survivor Joe Giardina about what he saw. Here's what Joe had to say about what it was like when the wave came in.
There was no hint of what was about to unfold. And when eventually the wave did come in, it's not the same. Don't picture this huge 20-foot or 20 or 10-metre wave. The water, it was just, you know, you get those extraordinary waves sometimes that just come along and just come a little bit further up the beach. Well, this was one of those, but it kept coming. So we were standing opposite the beach. We're having breakfast at the front of the sea view. And all of a sudden, you see the water comes up, and it's probably about, 4 inches of water that fronted up on the road. And I said to Ivana, goodness, look at this wave. It's up onto the road. But as soon as it hit a car, and it hit a four-wheel drive first, it started to push it forward. That gave me an idea of the push that the water had. So that was the beginning of it. But just about 4 inches of water coming up onto the road. But the thing was, it kept coming.
With Joe, tell us a bit more about him, because he was over there with his family.
He was an incredible man, and one of the most courageous men. I think I've spoken to in quite a long time. He was over there with his family, with his wife, Ivana, and their 16-year-old son, Paul. They have another daughter, but she just started a job, and so she remained back in Melbourne. So the family went over to Phuket, Joe, Ivana, and Paul. Paul had Down syndrome. He was 16, and they were having this wonderful family holiday, enjoying the sun, and they went down for breakfast, and they were in Phuket, in this resort called the Seaview Hotel, which is right on Patong Beach. And they're sitting there having breakfast and they're on the balcony, and Joe tells that just looking out and thinking, isn't this beautiful? The sun's shining and they're at Phuket and there's a beautiful beach, and something strange was happening in the water.
When we realised we were going to come up to the hotel, I said to Arlene, we better get out of here back into the hotel, because we're going to get wet. And obviously the concern was also, Paul suffered from Down syndrome, wasn't as mobile as he may have been. So I said, Paul, come on, let's go inside, Paul. And I grabbed him by the arms. They started running towards the back of the hotel, and the whole time looking around, and just the wave kept coming. But the further back I went, the higher the water was. So when it eventually did hit us, it actually hit us at waist height.
As they're beginning to do that, his wife Ivana, suddenly a car gets pushed between the two of them. Now, they're on the balcony of the hotel. So Ivana is separated from her husband and her child.
When I realised we were going to get hit, I put him up against the concrete pillar and then put my arms around him, thinking, this is as high as the water's going to get. But as soon as it hit us, it picked us both up and threw us over a dwarf wall, if you like. I managed to had Paul by the collar, but once it threw us over the wall, we got into water there, and something hit me on the back of the head, and I went under, and that's when I lost Paul.
Not long after, by sheer luck, he's found floating in the water. At the very back of the hotel, in a higher part of the hotel, because you've got to remember, by this stage, the bottom of the hotel is flooded. Everything was just flooded. There was a Sydney couple, Mark and Michelle Tang, who saw this man floating face down in the water, and they grabbed him and they pulled him out of the water. They pulled him up to safety into a higher part of the hotel. Now, Joe was unconscious. He had also suffered severe injuries. While he was holding on to the pillar, he got his hand smashed. He had broken ribs, and he also had a punctured lung. Meanwhile, Ivana was in another part of the hotel and out towards the street. She'd survived, and she's desperately searching for her husband and her son, but can't find them anywhere at all. Joe is taken upstairs, and so this terrific Sydney couple, Mark and Michelle Tang, are helping take care of him. And then there was another Aussie there, John Fay, who didn't know the Giardinas at all, but had met them the night before because he had a big, this is the way Joe tells it, he'd had this big moustache, and Paul, as he walked past, went, "God, look at that, look at that." He was, you know, laughing about the moustache, and John Fay was very good-natured, smiled back at them and gave them a wave and kept going. Well, thank goodness they'd made that kind of brief connection, because the next day, when the Tangs were taking care of Joe, John Fay was there at the same time, and he said, "Oh, yes, I know this man. I know he had a son and he had a wife." And John was outside the hotel also looking for survivors, and he saw Ivana walking up the hill because they had just been told there was another tsunami coming in. Remember, there were reports of different... there was another wave coming in, they had to be careful, and in some cases there were. Well, John actually saw Ivana desperately looking for her husband and her son, and John grabbed Ivana and said, "Come with me," and reunited them. So by this stage, Joe is very badly injured. Ivana's by his side, but they're wondering, where's their son? Where's their son who's gone missing? So these family members fly in from Melbourne, and they begin the search for the missing son. And they go, and Thailand had been so badly devastated. There were makeshift morgues in schools, in town halls, in wherever they could, because there were so many bodies. It's just tragic when you even imagine this. So these two family members are going from morgue to morgue to morgue, and then they go to one, and this is 3 days later, and they find Paul's body there, and he was deceased, and he drowned.
That must have been really heartbreaking for them.
It was absolutely shattering. It was shattering, and these family members then had to go and say to Joe and to Ivana, and Joe, as I said, was badly injured and trying to recover from this pretty awful injuries. They had to go and tell them that they... firstly, had found their son, but that he was deceased.
Paul was one of 26 Australians who were killed by the tsunami. In total, 230,000 people lost their lives in this freak event. John, I think we should talk to this just briefly if we can. Just to give people an idea of, when a tsunami or a big, obviously a massive wave like that comes in, and I've read this before, saying, and people, survivors saying, that it's like they get tossed around in a washing machine.
Yeah.
And it's obviously the water is full of debris, sharp objects.
Everything. It's full of glass. Paul was saying it was full of glass, it was full of broken timber, it was full of broken furniture, it was full of, he said, anything you can imagine that can be pushed, it was in the water. And when I said, you know, what do you remember, how big were the pieces were? He said, well, put it this way, the fact that a car was being pushed along the road like a matchbox, and the fact that he and his wife and son at one point were standing there, and the next minute there's a car being shoved between them by the force of this wave, gives you an idea of just what was in there. And so you can also imagine the water is so polluted by this stage because it's just got everything in it. It's got everything that you can imagine. So to say that he had to have his lungs pumped because they were covered in sand is you can imagine what else was in that water at the time.
What about, like, these the medical facilities, you know, the hospital, they must have been stretched to the limits.
Oh, it was pretty awful. In the case of Indonesia, I'm just out of Thailand for a minute, ports, roads, bridges were ruined. And here are some figures. More than 2,100 hospitals were damaged or destroyed. H's main hospital was really badly damaged. And across Indonesia, 400 health clinics were destroyed. So if you're facing a situation like that, how do you take care of people? What do you do? Thailand was as badly hit as it was. There were resources in other areas they were able to put into action. The Australian government, however, immediately responded, and the Australian government's emergency relief effort at that time was the largest peacetime operation Australia had ever launched overseas, the biggest thing we'd done overseas since World War II. And it was just, you've got to get these Australians home, because apart from the 23 people who very sadly died, there were many, many, many hundreds of other Australians who were really badly injured, because Thailand is such a popular holiday destination at any time. And in terms of a disaster relief operation. It was the biggest disaster relief operation since Cyclone Tracy had hit back in Christmas 1974. There you go. There's some kind of awful connection there. Boxing Day and Christmas Day are normally times of happiness, but in this occasion, just like Tracy, a very, very sad time.
Yeah, and John, tell me about, you know, what Joe did after the tsunami, because that's really inspiring.
It's really interesting. You might assume that somebody who's gone through this says, I never need to go back to Phuket again. I never need to go back to Thailand. In the 12 months that followed, Joe and Ivana went back twice. They went back about 6 months afterwards, and then they went back roughly about 12 months afterwards on the anniversary. And when I was asking Joe, I said, why'd you do that? He said, well, we went back because part of Paul is there. That's where Paul left this world. But they, and this is the incredible part. He said it was really important for them to healing their sorrow. But he said it's also, and he said, and this should never, ever be overlooked. He said, you need to remember what the Thai people went through as well. He said the Thai people were devastated. He would, so much devastation throughout what, through their country. Because don't forget, Thailand had 8,000 casualties. 8,000 people died, and many, many, many other thousands of people were displaced and injured. So he went back to help heal his sorrow. And he said whatever happened there, as horrible as it was, he didn't want to forget. He didn't want to forget that this is where they were having a wonderful time, a really happy time with their son. But he also wanted to make sure that there was, he had a connection with his son. And it's interesting, that reaction, when he said he had this connection with his son. He said, I just don't think anyone should be forgotten. With that, that actually sent Joe off on a mission, and it's a really inspiring mission. He was determined that none of the Australians who died or who survived the tragedy would ever be forgotten, and what an important, you know, part of recent history it was. So he began lobbying the various federal governments to have a memorial built in Canberra. Now, he started lobbying around 2005, 2006, and he is lobbying and lobbying and sending letters and emails and having meetings with people. And finally, in 2015, then Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull dedicated the quite beautiful Indian Ocean Tsunami Memorial in Kings Park in Canberra on the shores of Lake Billy Griffin. And he, in his dedication speech, Turnbull actually paid tribute to Joe to say Joe was one of the main people behind why this memorial was built. And it's actually quite a beautiful memorial. It's very simple, but it's really quite lovely. It's wave-shaped, and it has 26 pillars as part of the wave. And each one of those pillars represents the 26 Australians who died. Which brings us to where Joe is spending Christmas this year.
So he'll be down there this year for the anniversary.
Yeah, it's the 15th anniversary this year, as we said. And I said to him, what are you doing for Christmas? He said, I'm going to Canberra and I'm laying flowers at that memorial, and I'm going to be laying flowers where Paul's name is listed. And he said the most important thing about having a memorial like that is it keeps those people's memories alive, and it keeps what everyone survived alive. And it's quite powerful, and I think the next time I'm in Canberra, I'm going to make sure that I look at that memorial in a very different way. One of the most inspiring things about Joe is that I said to him, how do you overcome this kind of an experience? And this philosophy is really so astounding. He said, as awful as it was losing their beautiful son, he said they had survived, and it was important that he and Ivana continued to live, and they also have a daughter. And he said it's very easy to fall into a state when grief really overtakes you, but he said you need to find something within yourself where you continue to live and you learn to live with it, because they survived, so they have to keep living. They have to make sure that an active life that where they contribute to society, and they stay involved, and they still continue every day, is a really important part of being a survivor. And as awful as the grief is, he says, you have to find a way to continue going in your life. And they've done very well. They were involved in the building and real estate industry before all this happened. And when they got back, they changed their life. And they now have a shoe import business in Melbourne, in the suburb of Ivanhoe. And Joe was saying that shoe business, and it looks like it's actually an absolutely beautiful shop, has been a really important part of their recovery, because it gave them something to focus on and it gave them something that is beautiful to work with. And he said, and you have to find the beauty in life to continue going.
Thanks for listening to this season of Investigates. We'll be back next year with more incredible and unbelievable stories. Until then, listen to some of our top episodes of the year, like Australia's Most Haunted House or the case of Matthew Leveson. I'm Stephen Downey, and I'll see you next year.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.